a lot of people live in denial because they think that to be realistic is to be depressing.
I'm Dr. Mike, host of Going There.
It was the first song where I wrote about how I felt like my depression was killing me and I didn't want it.
Going There breaks the stigma of mental health issues by having real, honest conversations with your favorite musicians, including Alessia Cara, Lizzie Hale, Jewel, Jason Isbell, Gerard Way, Lauren Gray, Shamir, and Barty Strange.
There was something there that was so raw, where I was like, wow, I can't believe someone would say that.
Let's go there on Going There with Dr. Mike, brought to you by Sound Mind Live and the Consequence Podcast Network, every other Tuesday, wherever you get your podcasts.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Okay. Welcome. I'm David Frangione. What an exciting day this is, everybody. Modern Drummer presents Eric Singer and Nico McBrain. So today, before we bring Eric and Nico on, here's an overview of some of the things we're going to talk about. So Eric and Nico are going to talk about their drum kits, their cymbals, their setup, their approach to such kits. They both play different setups, as you everybody here knows. Single bass, double bass, different brands, the whole thing. We're going to talk about their early beginnings, when they started to play drums, what influenced them and inspires them for drumming, their practice and warm-up routines on and off the road. So, without further ado, we know exactly what we're doing here, everybody. Let's bring on Nico McBrain and Eric Singer live. Come on, guys. Here we go, Nico.
Hey, Eric. What's up? Hey, Dave. Hey, Eric. What's up, dude?
Nico, how are you?
Oh, very good, mate. Lovely. Hey, this is great to be doing this. Thank you, Dave, and everybody at Modern Drummer. And for your good self, great to share some time with you, Eric. It's been a long time since we've seen one another.
Yeah, are our signals clear, David? We no glitching?
Yeah, no, it's pretty good. You know, it's typical internet stuff, but
yeah.
we're gonna jump right into it. So this is not in any particular order, but let's start with, since we talked about drum kits, we'll start with Eric. And Eric, I want you to share your thoughts on your drum kit. I'm gonna bring up some slides here that kind of talk to what you're doing. So here we are. You've been with Pearl for 34 years. You're playing a custom fiberglass kit. Before we jump into the specifics of your kit, I know that you're kind of well-versed on all things Pearl, as Nico is on all things British Drum Company. So in the Pearl world, they've got these solid shell snares in four different materials and two different sizes that they're really excited about, that are really groundbreaking snares. They sound amazing, and I know you're a big fan of them. And they call it the Music City, the MCC, custom solid shell snares that are out now. So let's jump into your setup, and let's talk about you and Pearl and what you look for in drums, etc.
Close my door, because there's a lot of construction going on in this neighborhood. Well, just for the record, Pearl did make those one-ply back in the early middle 90s. For a while, they offered single-ply snare drums, similar to like a Radio King. But they didn't have re-rings, which means reinforcement rings. But they did do that at one time, because I have a couple of them. But they were very limited, short run. But that's what they're, you know, everybody's always reinventing the wheel. That's what I always say about drums and cars and everything. It kind of sometimes go backwards to go forward. And you know, like I'm using fiberglass drums, for example, which is something that was big in the 70s, and then it kind of went out of vogue. But I always like the sound of them, the attack and all that. So that's what I've been basically having a guy named Billy Baker in Nashville that resources old vintage Pearl kits, strips them down, and then puts modern he adapts to modern hardware. Like the only thing we use repurposed is the shells and the lugs from the 70s. Everything else is modern Pearl hardware. And I use the Icon rack system that Pearl makes now. So, but right now that's the phase I've been going through. And I think Nico will agree. You go through phases. Sometimes you hear a certain sound and you decide, oh, I kind of like that. I want to go for that. And like I was doing the Concert Town thing, as you saw those photos, but then I realized it was a lot more work to play the Concert Town. So I went back to double-headed toms to get the rebound and response plane-wise. And so I think drummers are kind of like, we're like kids. We look at our drums are like getting a new toy. Every time you get a new kit, you're like excited. And so you just want to keep experimenting and having fun. That's what keeps me inspired, to just make a new kit and try something different.
And then what about snare drums? What do you think about the new Music City Custom, the solid shell?
Well, the great thing about this Music City stuff is Pearl in the 80s, you used to be able to go and get anything custom made. Then they stopped doing that. And everything you had to order custom overseas, which was like a mass kit. But now they decided to make it accessible. You could order a kit from them and literally in 2 weeks, you're limited to a certain shells and certain finishes. But once you choose whatever you want, the configuration, they'll have it done in 2 weeks and sent out to you. Most drum companies, you order a special kit. It can take, I remember I used to play sonar as well, like Nico, from about 78 to about 86. And when I ordered my kit back in 78, it took me like 6 months to get it. But I was in America, mind you. They were coming from Germany. So to get certain stuff used to take a long time, especially if you wanted custom or specific sizes, rather than what we call the catalog kit, something you saw in the book, and you'd say, I want N95 or whatever, and they'd go, okay, boom, no problem.
Okay, so, and you've been playing Pearl for 34 years. So obviously you love the sound of the drums and you love what they give you for what you're looking for.
Well, ironically, I was playing sonar. They were going to give me a deal and then they changed their mind and Pearl called me up and said, hey, we want to give you an endorsement. I'm like, great. And that was it. I've been with them ever since.
Mm. Amazing. Okay. And one thing I want to share with everybody is that Pearl in 2021 is celebrating their 75th anniversary. So we're going to see some innovative products and we're going to see some really cool things coming up. So be on the lookout for Pearl drums next year. Now,
and David, I'm told that they're going to make some kind of really cool, special, maybe limited either items, drums, snare drum, or a kit that will coincide with that anniversary.
Okay. Nice. Nice.
But I don't know. But I did hear talk of it at the NAMM show this year.
So Nico, British Drum Company, this was big news. When this came out, everybody was like, what? So here we are, the British Drum Company. This set's gonna look very familiar to you. Question coming in about your kit and the painting and the customization on it. Woo, is just unbelievable. So let's talk about what's going on with the British Drum Company and your choice of drums.
Well, thanks, mate. Yeah, and Eric, great. 34 years, that's a true dedication. I mean, in our industry, I'm just going to digress a little before I answer your question. There's a lot of people that go for endorsements for the wrong reasons. They go for like, hey, man, I'm going to get this stuff for nothing. You have to love the product to use it. And Eric, 34 years with Pearl, that's beautiful. Now, having said that, that's very true. Loyalty, but people go, well, you've changed your drum company three times, Nick. Well, yeah, there's been reasons for that. I was with Sonar from 1976, like yourself from the early 70s, mid 70s, for 19 years. And then things changed politically. I then went with Premier. Then from Premier, I went back with Sonar, primarily because although I'd met Keith Keogh from the BDC, we had a four-year, we went back with Sonar for 4 years. And then I changed to BDC. So people go, well, were you talking about loyalty? That there is a loyalty in my why I use the equipment is, you know, because I love it. And Sona were my main go-to company. That's the very first drum set I ever bought when I was 16 years was a Sona Teardrop, which is now the Vintage Series drum set. And Premier had 22 years with those guys, you know. But having moved now, I had 4.5 years with Sona. They made me two beautiful drum sets, the Book of Souls drum kit and the Legacy of the Beast kit, which we're still actually are on tour for, which is a shame because I'm supposed to be in, I think I'm supposed to be in China, not China, beg your pardon, Japan or somewhere like that at the moment. But obviously with all the pandemic stuff, all music's on hold until next year. But having and a relationship with BDC has been incredible. Keith Keogh was making my drum sets with Premier from 2010. And he made a couple of amazing drum sets. So I knew what value this guy had as a drum manufacturer and as a master craftsman. So when things were kind of going a bit pear-shaped with Premier, Keith said, would you come on board and use these drums? That we'd actually designed a drum set while I was working with Premier and Keith and a guy called Craig Buckley. But unfortunately, you know, getting a hardware program, building a drum, you can build a set of drums in 2 or 3 days. Shells, and if you've got your hardware, you drill it up and it's not a problem. Designing new hardware, that's a different, you know, you have a lot of tooling to do. It's major expensive. Unfortunately, 5 years ago, British Drum Company didn't have their hardware. So I had to decline. And I said, well, look, you know, I'm going to have to go with somebody that, you know, I need to have to support me on tour. And so, you know, that's when I sat back with Sona. But since 4 years, 5 years have passed now, they've got this incredible hardware program together, Palladium hardware, and there's a line of it's called Casino, which is innovative stuff. It really is brilliant. And so a guy called Alan Kitchen designed the hardware program with BDC, and we just introduced that at the NAMM show. And the whole nuance of this company is like a family. It totally is, you know. I mean, I've had a great relationship with Keith and Craig Buckley, who is now actually working a couple of days a week with British Drum Company, and Craig incidentally is my partner in Drum One. So last year we designed a couple of snare drums together. I've always wanted to have my own metal snare drum, and so Keith found a guy 2 minutes across the road from the factory in Manchester in Stockport, who was a metal spinner. And this guy happened to be a massive Iron Maiden fan as well. But he didn't realize when Keith asked him to make a seamless snare drum for us, that he was actually making a snare drum for me. So it was really quite ironic because he made 12 of these snare drum shells. And when I finally announced that I was going with British Drum Company, he found out and he went, oh my Lord, this is Nico's drums I'm making for him. And he ended up making 40 of them in a week for the drum company, which is quite ironic because he said he could only make 12 a week before. Anyway, so he made these snare drums, 6.5, and it's a couple of mil thick. It's British stainless steel. And it's not stainless, I do beg your pardon, it's British steel. So he spun up one of those. And then I said to Keith, can I have a night my own wooden snare as well? And he said, well, let's do a different wood. As you were talking about, you know, the products changing, Eric, you know, like we hear something and you go, oh, I like that. Well, before that, I had a sycamore wood snare, which was which Keith made for me when we were Premier. Sona actually made a couple of snares with sycamore wood, but they were a little bit like, oh, it's not German wood, is it? You know, so they were a little bit upset about it. But nevertheless... Oh, yeah. You know, they were, oh no, we want to use German, you know, beechwood, which is cool with me. But so anyway, we made a snare drum of black oak, and that is what is which is available now. The drum set that you saw the photograph at the beginning, that came out of the snare drum, because once I saw the snare drum, I said to Keith, wouldn't it be nice if we had a legacy kit? Hello, what's happened?
Nope.
There it is. Okay, that one. So all square size toms. We have what's called fishtail oak on the outside. We have ten ply. It's 9 ply of oak, 2 beautiful mahogany reinforcement rings, a couple of ply reinforcement rings on there, and then and that was this legacy kit.
Nico, let me ask you real quickly. These shells are almost thicker to like the horse link, like the sonar signature type drums, right?
No, these are about 10 mil, 10 ply. They're 9 ply, and then you've got the outside ply makes up to 10. Right. I think the bass drum's 13, but they're very thin, Eric. They're not really, yeah. I mean, the new sonar beach kit, they got a light, a medium, and a heavy. And I went for a medium thinking that it would be like the half inch 9 ply Beechwoods of the old days, but they're very thin as well. So, different technique and technology of building tom-toms now. You know,
so Nico, you have a snare in steel and you have a snare in wood.
Yeah.
And Eric, what is your signature snare? What is it made out of?
Well, I've had two signature snares. One was a 10 ply maple snare that was a silver lacquer finish back in the early 2000s. But the one they make now is similar to like a core, what they call the Jupiter snare in the 70s. It's a chrome over brass, 6.5, with three center lines, kind of like, you know, Stuart Copeland was famous for playing a Pearl Jupiter snare on all those Police records. Even though he played Tama, he was always playing using a Pearl snare drum. Mm. But the question I have for Nico, because that Carl Palmer kit that you had, David, was made by British Steel. And you mentioned British Steel Shell. So is any relation there or no?
No, totally different guy. He's a fella up in Manchester. I think the fella that British Steel that made that kit was from London. I believe. Is that right, David?
I think so. Yeah.
That kit was built. I actually think I know where the workshop is. It was at the back of Euston Station, King's Cross, that area.
Wow.
And I think that kit weighs like 400 pounds or something crazy like that. It's got handles on the bass drum to lift it up.
The bass drum's 400 pounds.
The bass drum's
2 tons.
It's insane.
So guys, so that's what you're using for drums. Now, for cymbals, we've got Peisty and we've got Zildjian. Uh-huh. So just talk a little bit about, you know, what you're looking for in the cymbals and why you've chosen them. Everybody can go online and see what sizes and all that stuff. But what's behind the choice? You know, what do you like about them and how does it work for, because you guys are both playing huge places to huge crowds with loud music, loud on stage, high energy. Let's talk about Peisty and Zildjian. They're both great brands.
Yeah.
And I want to do a shout out to Kelly Peisty because she's been such a great supporter of all us drummers for so long and of modern drumming. I know she's a mutual friend of ours, Nico. So let's talk about Peisty and Zildjian. What do you guys think?
Eric, you want to kick that one off?
All right. Well, I mean, I think a lot of times what we play is what we were introduced to. And I grew up in Cleveland, Ohio. So if you grew up in Cleveland, you pretty much mostly played either Rogers drums or Ludwig, because Rogers originally remained in Cleveland. So it was very prevalent in that region of the country. And my dad could play a little bit of drums. And I remember he had a hi-hat with an old pair of Zildjians. So that was my first exposure, was Zildjian cymbals. And, you know, but I will admit, I have... Sometimes I love Sound Edge hi-hats, 2002s. I have like 3 sets of them. So sometimes for recording, it depending on what I'm doing, I will sometimes use a set of Peisty Sound Edge because those hi-hats are amazing for recording. But for a long time, I had kind of like a little combination. I was using a Peisty Sound Edge bottom and a Zildjian heavy bottom on top.
So I was using a combination of brands.
And for some reason, that was a great sound. And for most of, like, say, late 70s up to till the time I got a Zildjian endorsement, that was my hi-hat combo of Peisty and a Zildjian.
Excellent. Yeah. I think you're right. You know, when I started using Peisty, originally the first cymbal I ever actually bought, because when I had when I say I bought, I had Super Zins and Zins and UFIP cymbals from like on my very first drum set. And then the real, you know, they were like sort of inferior to the Zildjian and the Paistys that were around at the time. And my first cymbal I actually bought was an 18-inch heavy band Zildjian, 18-inch. And I'll never forget, it cost me 18 quid. In the old days, it was a pound an inch, okay? What do you mean I'm worth 50 bucks? What are you saying, darling? Okay. Anyway, so I bought this cymbal and I was in love with it. And I put it on my kit and I use it as a ride and it fell off the cup. And I was heartbroken. I was probably like 15 years old or something like that when I bought this cymbal. And then the next thing is I thought, a friend of mine worked in a music shop and he introduced me to the Sound 7 set. And this was a set of 602 Paisley cymbals. And I think there was a set of hi-hats, a 6-inch bell, a ride and a couple of crashes, you know. So I fell in love with the Paisley just because they looked so cool. And it wasn't really anything to do with the sound for me. And then I actually started to get, you know, do some session work when I was in my late teens. And I actually started buying Paisleys. And they just, the consistency of those cymbals, I'm sure it's probably like Zildjian. I'm sure they have, you know, anywhere you go in the world, you can buy an 18-inch heavy crash cymbal, 2002 you know, signature line cymbal. And it's the way they manufacture these sounds and they test them. They have a guy that sits, he's completely crazy. These people that they sit in a room and test the cymbals, got a master cymbal that travels around with the cymbals. The consistency is what really brought me into the cymbals and the sounds. So I've had this relationship and this love affair with the brand. And then I, you know, got involved with the family, with Tomas and Robert Paisley, who are no longer with us. And then met Eric, and Eric got married to Kelly, and we've had an amazing relationship. And I'm proud to be able to say that I'm an ambassador for the brand, as well as loving the cymbals. Now for live, I was always leaning towards the signatures because they cut across, so the band can really hear you when you're attacking a crash cymbal. Good bell and sticking sound off the rides.
And it's just rides are great.
Oh, they're just stunning. And, you know, I just have this love affair and this passion. And as I said, the other thing, I'm going to plug them a bit because now you can go online and you can actually probably order cymbals and there's a little sound library if you want. It's nothing like hearing the real thing. As you know, I still get a vibe when I go into a drum shop and see all these wonderful drum sets and this new gear, old gear, vintage stuff, cymbals. And I just have this love. I've always had bucket loads of cymbals around my drum set. So that's it for me. And you know, the consistency of wherever you are in the world, if they crack, you crack cymbals, I crack. You can't say you don't, because they do. They go. They work hard and over time. It's a brass alloy, and they work hard. And it's funny enough, some people go, "Well, my cymbal don't sound like it used to." Give it a year, it'll be fine. It'll come back. But we crack them. And the thing is, if you crack a Paisley, any one of their lines of cymbals in the top range, medium to top line, they're all handcrafted that you can go and they're tested. So you know you can just go pick one off the shelf, stick it on your drum set, and you're not going to hit it and go, that don't sound right. You know, cool.
That's important. Now, Eric,
David, I wanted to make a point to Nico's, to that exact point. There is different schools of thought. Some people, that is exactly the reason they like Paisley, because they go, if I break my crash, I go buy another one, it's going to replace it the same. But then there's the other school of thought, well, I like Zildjians because they're very individual sounding.
Yeah.
But you have to go through a bunch of them to find the ones that you think sound good to your ear. The only downside, when you break your favorite crash cymbal, especially your favorite ride or pair of hats, because those are the main things. You're not finding there. You're not going to find another one that's going to sound the same.
Yeah, yeah.
That's the downside to it. Vinny Caluta told me that he switched to Paisley for the exact reason that Nico just stated. He told me that he would go, because he plays all over the world. And he said, if I'm not carrying cymbals and I'm going to do something, a few dates in Japan or something, like some jazz stuff, he can get a set of cymbals there for him. And he goes, I'm going to get on the kit and they're going to sound exactly what I just left at home in LA.
Absolutely.
But now, Eric, you also play Zildjian drumsticks, right? Okay, so that's your drumstick of choice. I think you have a signature model.
Yeah, which is basically similar to like, I mean, I have to tell the truth. When I first started playing their sticks, I was one of the very beginning ground guys started playing them, and they were going through a few growing pains with consistency. And then eventually they said, hey, we'll make your own stick. So I tried different sticks to find something I liked. And basically my stick was a Joey Kramer model that was just cut down because Joey Kramer had redesigned a new model that he didn't like his old signature for some reason. So I thought his stick, Argo, I like the bead and it's just a little too long. So we cut off about that much and that became my signature stick. So that's actually the origin of my particular stick, which is kind of in a 2B family, if you will.
Mm. So pretty heavy stick. What do you play?
Yeah, you're a brute. You're a brute. That's all I can say.
Nico, how about Cozy Powell used to use those 2Ss?
Oh my gosh! I remember years back we did a show together in Rio, Rockin' Rio. I think it was 85. Michael Schenker was on the same bill that Maiden when we did our first. And I remember meeting him, and he came up and I won the Kerrang Music Award for top rock drummer, and he's always won it. And he came up to me and he says, "Oi, let me have a look at your hands." And I thought he was looking to you know, compare calluses. Because when we were younger, we'd beat the nine living daylights out of the drum set and try and break everything, which is not quite the way you're supposed to play. And I thought, I said, I've got a real bad. He said, no. He said, I want to see your finger and your forefinger and your thumb from writing all those votes that you sent in. And I'm like, oh, you cheeky bugger. But I said to him, what's going on? He said, I think I might start. And he actually went away from that to a lighter stick. Because I think, you know, as you get older, you know, your wrists start to play up and, you know, carpal tunnel.
You're right. I was a big Cozy Powell fan. I have one of his snare drums and I have his bass drum, black 26-inch Yamaha bass drum has with Cozy Powell.
Cool. Oh.
I got those off one of his kits. And I have some of his sticks, so I have the original big 2Ss. But he did go down to more like a, probably like a 2B.
Yeah.
Kind of using now. He went way down in size. You're absolutely right. Because
you
get older, and think about it, he was only 50 when he passed away.
Yes, tragic, yeah.
Young guy. So guys, let's, Nico.
Yeah, Mike.
You're a drum nut like the rest of us. Eric and I have, like yourself, big drum collections. I'm sitting in the Modern Drummer Hall of Fame. It's Alex Van Halen's drum kit right there. And you know, amazing kits. Now you start a drum shop.
Nico McCrae's
Drum One. And so just talk for a minute about that, because I think it's just so cool and what a show of passion.
Yeah.
Because tell you, walking into a drum shop is so
exciting. Nico's fulfilling the drummer's dream. All of us remember going to an amazing drum shop when we were kids. We had one called Terra 2 Percussion in Cleveland when I was a kid. And this guy was like a drummer's drummer, always had the newest stuff, you know, Odd Kids, Milestone, Tempest. He's the first guy that had sonar drums when I was a kid. And you always wish, man, I'd love to have a drum shop. And so you're getting to fulfill that dream that we all wish we could have.
Absolutely. And it really came about, funny enough, by accident almost, because, I spoke earlier about Keith Keogh and Craig Buckley. Craig Buckley was the GM of Premier for a number of years at around the time that I met Keith. Anyway, he called me about 3 years ago and he was saying, oh, you know, the Manchester Drum Center, the guy, I think his name's Roy, it was selling it. And he said, I'm thinking of, buying this drum shop. He said, so it sounds like a real good, you know, he's got 70 grand's worth of stock. It comes in with the deal and all this, you know, malarkey. Anyway, right. Long story short, actually even longer, he's on the phone and he's going, so, you know, what do you think? I said, so what are we going to call it? And because the association of the two of us was always we, meaning me, him and Keith Keogh, doing all these things together with Premier and whatnot. And I said, what are we gonna? He says, oh, you want in then? And I said, yeah, sure, why not? So that's how it came about. Let me put it this way. I didn't start off over these years thinking that's what I was going to do, was to buy a drum shop. I had that passion when I was a lot younger, and it never really occurred to me to even think about it until somebody sowed that seed, which was Craig.
Now look at the shop. Like when somebody comes in there, or I've visited it online, and it's just a lot of fun, and it's got a lot of cool Nico Maidenism like kind of vibe.
Well, the thing was, you know, obviously once we started to talk about it, and he said, do you want to come in as a partner with me? And we're 50-50. There's no, I've got more than him or anything like that. We got Sam McCowan as our general manager, and Phil Pesky. Phil Pesky, he's a right love. So there's four of us. And so the idea was to use it as Nick Hummett Brains Drum One. And obviously we had a lot of, you know, we had the Sonosphere in there. We got Planet Pisces, all of my top endorsee stuff. I'm trying to push more, obviously, because that's why I use it. But to walk it, when I'll never forget the first day I walked through that door, was like, Eric, as you said, when you were a kid, you know, a lot younger. And I had that feeling like I still get when I go into a pawn shop, which got drums and stuff in, or no pawn, P-A-W-N, boys and girls. You know, that you have that passion for that still, we still carry that passion, as you do too, Dave, across your life. You never lose that, you know. And to actually own a drum store and see this, And of course, going to NAMM show this year, I was actually going around as a retailer, meeting guys that were making snare drums and different drum companies, and going to see who you know, obviously Sona, you know, we talked to Sona, but unfortunately I can't just sell their snare drums. I have to sell all their drums. So I said, okay, well, you know, we can still do that. There's no animosity. This is a business, you know.
Well, it's fantastic. I just think as a fan and as somebody who's, you know, especially there's so many guys who've grown up inspired by both of you guys. But in your case, Nico, now they can go and shop drums that you've kind of handpicked, like, okay, this is how I'd like a drum shop to be.
Yes, exactly. And,
it's exciting. It's exciting stuff. So
I've just got to say one thing is a bit of a bugbear for us right now, because obviously with this pandemic on, I think the idea is to open in a couple of weeks, because a non-essential business, retail businesses are asked to hold off for a bit, right? So and you say non-essential, of course it's essential. We got to buy our cymbals, our new drum sets, our new drum heads and drumsticks. Now the problem is, we can't have the kids come in the shop and go up and pick a pair of sticks out and try them, which is a bit sad, because, you know, when kids are starting off, or even adults that have decided to pick up a pair of sticks, they got to know, you know, they're not going to pick up two S's or two B's. You know, they're going to go for maybe an E or a foot, you know, or usually five A's or B's or something like that. So now we can't have kids handling them. And so that's a bit of a bugbear for us, you know. And it's still going to beat Nine Living Daylights out of a drum set, if you like. But you've got to bring your own sticks.
Well, Nico, do you remember in the early days of the 70s, Vic Firth sticks used to come in a sealed bag. You couldn't play them.
Yeah.
And they used to be pitched pair. They were matched, supposedly.
That's right.
They were in a sealed bag. So you couldn't try them out. You had to just buy the bag or the pair of sticks that way.
Yeah.
That's yes, right.
different days. Yeah, now the kids, you know, we offered you know, practice pads or snare drums for kids to pick a pair of sticks out, and you know, we'd have, you know, demo sticks, if you like, and they could use them. But obviously now we're going to have to rope that, or, you know, put a little rope off there until such times as I mean, if they come in with a pair of sticks, they can have a go on a drum set and try some new stuff out. But, you know, still
be keeping it.
Yeah, and you know, we're not going to be able to see live music and audiences in their throngs, as we say, for a while now, as we know, because of this nasty pandemic. But, you know, it doesn't mean to say you can't still practice at home. And, you know, I must admit, electric drum sales have gone up pretty well.
Oh, they sure have. And in fact, talking about practicing at home, let's talk about you guys, your early beginnings, when you started to play drums, your influences, your inspiration, from what got you into it to kind of what inspires you today and keeps you motivated and still is an influence. I know Eric mentioned Cozy Powell, so I want to hear Eric's thoughts. I want to hear your thoughts, Nico. Let's talk about influences and inspiration and starting from beginning to now in kind of a consolidated timeline of what you could give the readers, the viewers today for insight and really advice through your insight.
Go ahead, Eric. You kick off.
A lot of it's based on, I've always been more of a band guy, so I was always inspired by a band, and then if I like the band, usually the drummer follows suit with that. You know, like I was geeking out a little earlier being a fanboy than Nico, because my brother one day brought home Pat Travers' album, and in the 70s, and I was like, brother, I was like, holy shit, what's this? And I loved it, and it was Nico on drums. And the drum, by the way, Nico, your drum sound that you got on those two Pat Travers albums you did, especially, I think, putting it straight. You know, there's that one song where you do the face, the instrumental.
Oh, yeah.
You do the big opening fills. And
yeah.
The drum sound is so great on that album. And I just think you're playing, I always thought, like, when you play Maiden, it's obviously great, but you really, like, had a funk R&B. You were like a white funk drummer when you were in Pat Travers.
Yeah, true.
And very, like, a lot of it, you know, that music is very syncopated, and it's a lot of riff rock. So your drumming style was, like, perfect for that. And so I always wondered, like, who were your influences? Because when I hear you playing that stuff, it's like you're, like, a different drummer on that music. Literally.
Well, and, yeah, I mean,
Nico, before you answer that, I want to add, we got a ton of questions about Nico and his approach to grooving from that exact era. And it was awesome to see how many people have followed your career from then to now and are still being inspired and influenced by that style as much as we got a lot of Where Eagles Dare questions, which we'll get everybody, so simmer down. But we got a lot of the funk and, like, another side of you.
Well, sorry, go ahead, Eric.
No, I was going to say, it sounded like you must have been influenced by all those Motown and R&B drummers, because you can hear that influence in your drumming on those records.
Yeah, well, I can't, my early, you know, I went through the pop phase when I was learning, you know, the Stones, Beatles, and Marvin Gaye, all those kind of guys. I was playing sort of pop music, soul music, went into blues. And then obviously from my style, from what I was playing, the music that I was playing in, you know, in the late 60s, early 70s, then transferred into this kind of funk stuff. I mean, that was my main go-to, what I loved to play. I used to play in a band called Major Bull, and we were doing stuff like Blood, Sweat and Tears, Chicago songs, but still had that, Danny Seraphine had that stunning funk groove himself. He had these incredible chops, and, you know, so my style came from all these different genres of music. And then from that, I went into a band called Streetwalkers, which were actually a blues rock funk band. And they were just, I did two albums with these guys, Downtown Flyers and Red Card. And the bass player was, you know, to move on to how how my style progressed was the bass players that I played with. They were the primarily funk players. And then when I came out of Streetwalkers and went with Pat Travers, we had the great, wonderful Miles Peter Cowlin on bass.
Amazing yeah. bass.
And that guy and I, we just clicked, because I had this funk side to me. And yet I also had a flamboyant side, which was the more percussive player, because there was only three of us. And in a three-piece, you have to kind of, you can't just sit on time all the time. You've got to kind of get a little bit more flamboyant, and hence those kind of drum fills coming out that I did on Pat Travers, Putting It Straight. Two different drum sets. So as we said earlier, I mean, on the Making Magic, I had a Heyman kit, 22 bass drum, 12, 13, 16 floor. I had an 8, 10 and a 12 staccato tom-tom, which was, funny enough, talking about fiberglass, they were made of fiberglass. And so then the Putting It Straight album was when I moved to Sona. The first time I had a Sona drum set was in 76, 77. So that was the you know, microphone up the bum of the drum, because there's no bottom head on it, concert rack. But that my style really came from the place, bass players I was playing and the music I was listening to at that time. So moving on, Pat then went from, you know, heavy, bluesy, riffy stuff, you know, and I could open and shred out a bit. And then I went from there and ended up playing in, doing a bunch of sessions. And then I ended up playing with a guy called McKitty, which is another free piece, right? Donovan McKitty and Charlie Tumorai from Bebop Deluxe was on bass. Another great bass player.
He was great. I saw them a few times.
Yeah, phenomenal. So then from there, I ended up working with a French rock band called Trust. But I still took that early genre, that feel that I had through my early, because I grew up listening to the greats in the 60s. You know, it was 63 when I first really got into playing. I was 10 years old. I'm an old git, boys and girls, so watch out. Respect your elders, that's all I can say. You know, that's where my influences came from, those bands of that time and that genre. So, yeah.
Yeah, I just thought the drumming you played on those records, they were very, and I'm going to be like, I'm very honest here, they were very inspirational to me and influential. Because, you know, I'm surprised I didn't discover Pat Travers on my own. My younger brother brought the record on.
Oh, yeah.
That was it. So I was hooked. And those records, I still didn't put it straight to the best of all of his albums he ever did. That album's amazing.
And then, Eric, who else? You were inspired a lot by Bonzo, right?
Yeah, everyone. Cozy Powell, you know, Denny Carmassi, Tommy Aldridge, Buddy Rich, Simon Phillips, Carmen Appice, you know, the usual suspects.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Nico, you're a big Buddy guy too. I think all three of us are huge Buddy fanatics. Absolutely.
Well, I don't think anybody that can that plays drums, there was no one ever since Buddy that can match. I mean, there's phenomenal players. Eric's great, Thomas Lang, people like that. There's so many great players today, but we all owe what we've got to the one maestro, which was, to, in my book, was Buddy Rich. He was incredibly flamboyant, amazing speed, amazing style. And all drummers, if you talk to a drummer, says, "Oh, I prefer Gene Krupa." Well, yeah, I prefer Gene Krupa because he was a bit more rocky, but I still put Buddy Rich at the top of that list. Without a doubt, you know, you get these greats, Buddy Rich, you have Gene Krupa, you've got Louis Belson, the great Ed Shaughnessy, all these great Ed Thiepin, all these amazing guys from the 30s and 40s that we all take what we've got from them. And I mean, the guy that set me off, which I didn't mention in that great list because of the reason, is he was the man that made me start to pick a pair of sticks, that was Joe Morello. And, you know, people go, "Well, you've got all these great jazzers. Why don't you play jazz?" Well, I grew up in the era where the popular music at that time was soul and pop and R&B. I've lost you. Hello, where you gone?
We're here.
There you are.
We're here.
Yeah, so, you know, of course. So Joe Morella started me, and my chronology was Ringo Starr. Joe got me going. I saw him do a solo with Dave Brubeck and went, that's it, Dad. I'm going to be, who is that fella? Oh, that's Joe Morello. I want to be like him. You'll never be as good as Joe Morello, son. And that was it. My career in drumming started there. Then it was Ringo Starr, Charlie Watts, the wonderful and great Keith Moon, and then John Bonham. Those four guys primarily molded my style of playing. And of course you had Carmine Appice, Dino Danelli, all those kind of guys. And of course, the wonderful and great Ian Pace. And all of the people that we've been mentioning are just stunning and are great role models for any drummer to listen to and get going.
Yeah, those are all amazing drummers. Yeah. Your practice and warm-up routines, either on the road, off the road, before a show, if you even have time to practice before a show. I know in Eric's case, he's got to do. So what do you guys do to just keep not only staying, limber and fresh and in shape, but growing your drumming? What are your routines? What do you do?
Eric?
I think just keeping in some reasonable physical shape. A lot of times stretching is really important. I use resistance bands and just keep myself stretched out and limber. Try to just do that because I think that helps a lot. I don't get a lot of opportunity when we're actually on tour because of our schedule and getting ready with all the costumes and stuff to get to warm up, which is really something I miss. When I played in other bands, I did have time to warm up. In this situation, I don't.
But, and what do you do when you can warm up or when you're off the road and you can play and practice? What do you work on?
I do probably the most typical things most guys do, play singles and doubles, and paradiddle inversions of different paradiddles, just because most of the things you play are single or double strokes. So they're kind of applicable to whatever you're playing. And it's really about just keeping your muscle memory, your fingers and your wrists limber. And because it's like riding a bike. If you don't play for a while, you're going to be a little wobbly at first, and before you know it, it comes right back.
Yeah. Yeah. For me, I'm fortunate enough to be able to take a small drum set on the road with me, other than me big one. And the primary reason I do that is so I can annoy my tour director. He freaking hates it. He goes, because sometimes backstage you can't find a separate room. And by the way, the rest of the band have all laid the law down and said, do not put Nico next to the dressing room, okay? Now, sometimes you can't, backstage doesn't allow that freedom of being able to choose a room away from everybody. But I take a four-piece kit, and I usually start off with just a hi-hat, two and four groove, and then I start, I do like a quarter note on the bass drum, and then I double that up, and then I do a 16 note just to get my footwork in. And then, of course, the proverbial Where Eagles Dare, because we're doing that in the show anyway, I usually end up picking a song, which is one of the more difficult songs to play, to warm up to. And that Where Eagles Dare as the middle eight section, as like the four quarter notes on the bass drum in a pattern that is just not just on side of the triplet feel, but it gets my foot going. And then I just thought that, like Eric, do singles and doubles and do press rolls. And then I tend to try, when I say try, I execute triplets. And it'll be, right, left bass drum, right bass drum, left, left. The one I always find, the left, right bass drum one, completely one of them, So I just might mess around and just try and get my dexterity going. At home, as Eric said, you don't play for. I mean, I probably practice twice a week now. I'll go in and have a knock, when I go in and play on my kit, I've got the Book of Souls drum set in the studio, and I'll just sit down and shred a solo. And then if I hit on something I like, I'll work on it and try and break it down and try things left side first, which is one great thing I think all drummers need to know. If you're right-handed, work on primarily starting left side and strengthening quarter and eighth notes on your left hand, and leading fills, if you've got more than two or three toms, you can do that. If you've got a four piece, it's a bit hard to get down to the right side, first of all. But it's nice to be able to do that sort of thing. So I drive people nuts for about 10 to 15 minutes before I go on stage at a maiden gig. So,
you'll do 15 minutes on the kit and working through some of the things. That's enough for you to just get loose, get the muscles going.
Yeah, and again, as I say, I can annoy. And so this is really true stories. You know, so we played a couple of shows in Brazil, and they had these you know, the mock-up dressing rooms that they sort of like they put together. And I was in one dressing, and there was no ceiling, just walls, right? And the production office was literally across from where I was playing. And I'm playing, and all of a sudden, three drumsticks are all over the onto the top of me and on the kit. It was like, what the heck? And I could hear Ian Day, my tour director, "Oi, shut that bloody noise up." So I picked the three sticks up, added another couple and threw them back. And we started having a war. And these drumsticks are flying over the wall. It's hilarious. But the band, they're great. They go, "Oh, can you keep it down to 5 minutes if we're not next door to one another?" You know, because there's nothing worse than just hearing a drummer crack out a solo. You know, when I say that, that's for the guitar players in the band and the would-be drummer singer. He's okay, but here's another thing. I'm just going to tell you a real story. I play left hand out, right? And the reason I do that is I get a bit more weight for less effort on the snare drum. More dynamic. And so when I play, I always leave my sticks on top of the floor tom on my big kit or on my practice kit. So what happens is Bruce Dickinson will go in and decides he's going to have a whack in the afternoon if he's in early or whatever. So he picks that pair of drumsticks up but turns them around the normal way. So he hammers it and chips all the wood off, right? And he sticks them back in the bag. So I go on, all right, or he might leave them and I pick them up. Of course, what happens? I'm playing it butt end out where he's been beating all the cymbals up with a stick, whatever. That's a bad thing. So whatever you do, boys and girls, when your would-be drummer, singer, bass player or guitar players want to have a go on your drum set, give them their own sticks. That's all I can say. Just bear that in mind.
You play left hand with the butt end out.
Yeah, always have done, yeah.
I do that sometimes. I used to do that earlier years to get that more oomph, more weight.
Yeah, and it's less effort, you know. And I mean, Eric, when we were younger, I'm pretty sure I remember seeing you with Alice Cooper. And the last time I actually saw you playing was with him, and we were in where was it? Either.
It was one of the big festivals in Europe.
I don't think. The one I remember was you guys played, and it was the Stairway to Heaven golf tournament. And I'm trying to remember where it was. It was a good number of years ago, and you guys were playing it. But yeah, anyway, I forgot what I was going to say to you. But yeah, you know, I find that you know, when we were younger, we try and break everything, hit them hard. Give it some, you know, because that was how you thought you had to play, you know, especially in a rock and heavy metal band or hard rock band, you know.
People told kids, you got to play harder. You got to play harder. You got to have power and drive the band.
I found it easier, easier to get a little bit more dynamic out of that sit. The only thing is you have to practice doing a single stroke roll evenly because you get, plus the fact is the actual drumstick sounds different. The note of the stick, you know, because you've got more wood, this is, so it's a denser sound. And the dynamic is you have to adjust the left side. So I'll bring the right up a bit more to do an even stroke single or even a double. So that's the only difference of, you know, where in a practice routine, you have to change it out a little bit, you know. But I find it, you know, being on an old git, I need all the help I can get out of here. And I mean, this is a weird thing. People say, you got a massive PA out front, why don't you just play quietly and let the PA drive the sound? Now, that's all very well. A drum kit, actually, the lighter you hit it, the better it sounds, the bigger it sounds. Because when we're actually powering it, it's choking the air. It's too quick, you know. True. So, you know, you look at people like J.R. Robinson, you know, he doesn't hit the kit hard. And even Vinny, you get these amazing big sounds. But, you know, we're in a rock band. The guys on stage want to hear that kit. They want it, you know, they ain't going to rely on a monitor system. Well, that's why, you know, Bruce is always up behind me. He don't want to be down listening to the monitors. So, you know, there's a lot of equations that have to be taken into consideration as to how your style develops with your band.
Yeah, no, it makes perfect sense. So, guys, we've got so many questions. So we're picking the ones that represent the vast majority, because we'd be here for 2 weeks if we answered even half of them, literally. But we're going to get to most of them just through the similarity. So first one, Nico.
Yeah, Mike.
How did you end up playing barefoot? And did you have to make adjustments to your playing to accommodate it? Or was it just easier to play that way? What's the story?
Well, I think it stems back to when I was learning to play. No, I haven't got COVID, boys and girls. I hope not anyway. Just a frog in the throat. when I was practicing as a kid in my front room at my mum's house, I played in bare feet, and it was just a natural feeling for me to play. And then as I went through my career, I went through my first professional band, real touring band, was Streetwalkers, and I'd take my shoes off and socks off and stand them next to my hi-hat stand. And then it just grew from there, and I played without shoes on. And then I found boxing shoes, Lonsdale boxing shoes, a very thin sole. I like to be able to feel the bass drum pedal and the hi-hat stand. And so then I used boxing boots for a while, and I transferred that into Maiden because I was using a Speed King pedal forever. It was my chosen bass drum pedal. And the problem with the Speed King pedal, it had ribs on it. And it, you know, there was slots on the around the edge of the footplate, or you know, about half inch in from the edge of the footplate, and it kind of would tear your foot up. So I ended up using the boots, and then DW came out with a 5000 pedal, which was quite smooth, and it only had the 5000 embossed on the plate. So I went to bare feet again. So I flip flopped. That's weird, isn't it? Flip flop with bare feet. So I then. When I went with the DW, I started to go back to playing in bare feet again, because that's how my preferred play. It's just because it's like, no disrespect for drummers that play with gloves on. Some drummers do that to protect their fingers or whatever, you know, or they feel they can get more power. I don't know. I feel that I need to feel the wound. Hey?
Just kidding.
It's not girls.
I never understood the glove thing. I just
no.
I got to tell you, when I was younger, I played barefoot as well.
Yeah.
And we didn't have drummer shoes, and I wanted to feel that connection. Yes. I would take my shoes off. And I wrestled as a kid, so that I wore wrestling shoes, which are like boxing shoes.
Yeah, very similar. Yeah.
Very thin. But a lot of times when we go out and do the encore, I come out and take my boots, you know, I put my boots on just to come out and take a bow. When I go back, a lot of times I would just leave my shoes off and play with just the socks on. That's what I did as a kid. I played barefoot like you.
Yeah.
I wanted my foot to feel really connected, and I just felt like a better control.
Yes.
So for the encore, Eric, for the encore, you would sometimes just play barefoot as well.
Barefoot or just with the socks on. But I'm like Nico. As soon as he started saying this, I'm like, oh my God, I did the same thing as a kid, because it just felt better. I had better control. Mm. I liked feeling my feet on those pedals.
Yes.
So, Evan, question for you. Do you, what was it like to record with Black Sabbath in the late 80s? And a person asked, what was the departure of Glenn Hughes like? So, a little off topic coming, but go ahead.
When I first played with Tony Iommi, that was supposed to be a solo album, which became a Black Sabbath album. And Glenn Hughes sang on it. That was actually the first record I ever did in my life. So I had no idea what the hell I was doing. I just kind of made it up as I was going along. And Glenn had never fronted a band just as a singer without a bass. And he didn't even know he wasn't going to play bass until he showed up at rehearsals, and there was a bass player, a guy named Dave, you know Dave Spitz, Nico?
Yes, sir. Yeah.
Dave the Beast. So Glenn shows up at rehearsals, and he's like, nobody told me bass, swear to God. So it was just, you know, he was like a fish out of water. And so after about five shows, he was struggling. So we got this guy named Ray Gillen, who somebody found him in a club in New Jersey. And he became the singer. And so it was, you know, it was Sabbath, a learning.
That Black Sabbath record, that was your first record?
Yeah, Seven Star. And then we did another album called Eternal Idol with, and Bob Daisley came in to play bass on that, and Ray Gillen was the singer. But then there was a lot of management issues, so I left, and I went with Bob Daisley to play with Gary Moore, and Ray Gillen ended up quitting. He was going to have a band with John Sykes and Cozy Powell, which that never happened. You know, and it just kind of all fell apart. Everybody went their separate ways. But it was, you know, I loved playing with Tony because the guy writes the best heavy riffs. The guy's mm-hmm. the king of that. You know, and, you know, but it was just probably not the ideal time to be in that situation for Black Sabbath, unfortunately. Mm-hmm.
Well, still an amazing, amazing, amazing moment in your life, yeah. Especially that early on. Mm-hmm. So, Nico, how did you end up in Trust? And was this, this particular reader says, was this before or after the band's famous meetup with AC/DC's Bon Scott?
Ah, yeah, it was after, actually. But, okay, so they did an album called, I think it was Repression, was their first album. And they were in Scorpio Sound in London. It's not there anymore. It was a room in a room studio. You know, you'd appreciate this. I mean, it was on springs and it was a stunning room. And it was in Houston, underneath Houston Tower. It's a Sainsbury's now, would you believe it? But anyway, so they were in the studio doing a mix on some songs that they recorded. And they were working with a guy called Dennis Wainwright. Now, Dennis Wainwright was the engineer on Making Magic. And they got talking about Pat Travers. And Nono Krief, the guitar player, turned around and says, oh, Pat Travers is one of my favorite, he's one of my heroes. And Dennis turned around and said, whoa, I know Nico, the drummer. And he went, no, you don't. This is God's honest truth. And Nono didn't believe that he knew me. So, next thing, I'll get a phone call, and Dennis says, here, I've got this French band. He said, they're bigger than, you know, they're bigger than sliced bread in France. Have you ever heard of them, called Trust? I said, yeah, I've seen their logo with a big bulldozer thing, you know, contraption on, you know. He said, well, the guitar player doesn't know I know you, but you need to have a word with him. So he put him on the phone, and Nono was like, I don't believe I'm speaking to Nico from, you know, they're two of my favorite albums and this, that, and the other. He said, do you want to come to the studio and have a jam? Which I did. And we played for about 4 hours straight. Apparently there's a tape of it somewhere, quarter inch. And that was it. That's how I began, how I sat into, it was in 1980, late 79, 1980. So then they offered me the gig, but the only thing was I had to commute to Paris. No big deal, well, I suppose, you know, it was an hour flight. But anyway, so I worked. I had 5 days rehearsal with them, and then I did a first show in Paris Saint-Germain. I can't remember the name of the gig. It was a massive gig. It was like a conservatory sort of place, all glass. And of course, I had to learn 24 songs in 5 days, and they didn't have a set list. This is the God's honest truth. So I've got Boom Boom, the drum tech, sitting behind me, and Bernard be speaking French, which I don't speak. So we're going to do Lalite. I go, how the fuck does that one go? Oh, sorry. How's that go? And he come up and he sort of hummed the song to me. And oh, right, I got it. And I'd count it off. And I remember about halfway through this first show, I thought I knew what song I was doing. And I counted it off and it was the wrong tune. And that was it. So and that's how I got the gig.
Wow.
I didn't get fired after the big cock up. But I did 2 years with them. I did an album actually with them.
So Eric,
I gotta say something. You know, when Nico was in Pat Travers, they were like a musicians band. So everybody was a whatever. You love Pat Travers because you realize the high level of musicianship. But a lot of people may not know Pete Willis, the original Def Leppard guitar player. He loved Pat Travers. He wore his hair, played a melody. He right exactly.
Yeah.
Mini Pat Travers.
Mini Pat, yeah. That old melody.
So, Eric, your drum sound on the first Badlands album, what'd you use for drums? What kind of room did you record in? There's a huge amount of fans out there that just love the sound of your drums on that record and other records, and they want to know specifically what you do in the studio.
That was a Pearl, well, it was two different kits, because it was done in LA, New York, one-on-one studios here in North Hollywood, the big room. That's, if you look at the record, it said East Side, West Side on the label, and the songs on the West Side were done in California, East Side, New York City, at the record plant. But both times, it was Pearl MMX Maple kits.
Okay. Pearl MMX. And what do you, and any special techniques in the studio, or just close mic'd, standard stuff?
Ambient room mics that went close mic'd. We tried to go for more natural type sound, although I know they did use some sound replacement reinforcement a little bit, I was told, when they mixed it, which a lot of people were doing, whether even though drummers didn't want that or like that, but you know, producers and engineers have their methods and techniques sometimes, and you know, what's sometimes frustrating, you go and you get your initial sound, you spend all this time or whatever, you get a lot of great sounds, and you hear the rough stuff, you go, wow, this sounds great, raw, ambient, real drum sound, and by the time you hear the final mix thing, you're like, what happened?
Right, sure. Yeah, now there's a lot of tricks in the studio that get applied sometimes. Nico.
Yeah, Mike.
How did you come up with the intro groove to Where Eagles Dare? Now, let me just say up front, Where Eagles Dare is one of my favorite Clint Eastwood movies.
Yeah.
And one of my favorite Maiden songs. But the fan base out there are obsessed with this song. I mean, it's like one after the other after the other. Where Eagles Dare, Where Eagles Dare. Yeah. So let's talk about Where Eagles Dare.
Well, you
can
know.
Can I ask you something, Nico, before you go?
Yes. Yeah, go ahead, Mike.
Before you go on to describing this, I always thought that something about the drumming reminded me of Manic Depression by Hendrix. Like somehow you took that influence thing and then you made your own beat.
Yeah, well, I mean, Mitch Mitchell was a big influence too. You know, when we were talking earlier on about, you know, listen what music you were listening to and what you know what you take from people. Mitch was a stunning player. I mean, he, you know, there's that classic three piece where he would not just sit on time; he'd be flying out all over the shop. And funny enough, you know, Mitch Mitchell, he had lots of lessons from Jim Marshall, the man who made the amplifiers. So not a lot of people know that, but anyway. Jim actually was a drummer and singer, and he started off when he was 12 tap dancing. He had a lot of physical issues when he was a kid, and the doctors said, you need to go and do tap dancing, and he did, and then he was the only fella in this tap dancing class, and they asked him to do this Christmas play, you know, Christmas pageant thing, and they said, we need you to sing for us. So he started singing. And then he started to take the drums up, and he actually was a very well-renowned drum teacher in the late 40s and 50s in England. Not a lot of people know that either. Anyway, Mitch was, thank you for that compliment. That's really nice. But Where Eagles Dare, there's a long story behind it, and I won't tell you the whole story, but when Steve came up with the riff, he said, I've got this riff, I'm still writing the song. He said, but I want a big drum intro. And I went, well, how big do you want it? He said, as big as you like. So I said, can you show me what the riff is? And he said, he's put his bass on. He's going, right. Right. And I'm going, no, that's the guitar part. What are you playing? He said, no, that is it, Soppy. I went, okay, so it's all triplets, right? Oh, gosh. I should put a disco beat to that. You know. So anyway, first part was, he's gone off, he's carried, he said, I'm going out and finish, I'm halfway through the song, I've got to still finish it off. So he said, go ahead and do the drum fills. So I started on the 6-inch drum, went all the way down the kit, such a stupid drum fill. Well, that'll do. Harry called him down. He came down. I said, I did this big drum fill. And he stood there in front of the bass on his arms. And he went, I said, what's wrong with it? It's too long. I said, I thought you said you wanted a big F off drums fill. Yeah, not that big. So So I thought, all right. I started, I went, something stupid like that. He's gone up, he's come back down. All right! Then he's gone, Nah, still too long. And then, if I recall rightly, Bruce came in and was saying, well, why don't you do it like something like, you know, and it started like, and then Harry went, oh, babbly-doodly, something like that. And I went, oh, okay, fair enough. And so he's buggered off, and I sat there, and I just came up with that babbly-doodly. So he's come back down, I've played it. He went, that's it, that's great. I said, right, now we're going to make the rhythm work behind what you're playing. So he stood with the bass, and we worked out the rest of it, which is all based around a triplet. And then the rest of the song, we actually learned in NASA at the Compass Point Studios. But it was the first track that we actually recorded when we got there. So we had to learn the rest of, you know, because he had it up to the... to the all the solo section, and then we had to arrange the rest of it. But
the main beat you're playing, to a kick snare and cymbal, right?
Yeah.
That always reminds me, not the same beat, but it. I always thought, oh, this sounds like Mitch Mitchell. It's like a Mitch Mitchell kind of Jimi Hendrix Experience band beat.
I see. Well, I wasn't consciously thinking of that, but I'll take it.
So obviously, if you're old enough to know that generation of music, when you hear somebody play something, you go, oh, I kind of get the influence.
I think sometimes subconsciously we might all lend things from each other. You know, there's only so many beats and so many rhythms, and it's the permutations of them that sometimes you can play a part and it'll remind you. It's like a melody. You know, sometimes you hear a piece of music and you go, oh, that reminds me. It's not a direct nick, but it's very close. You know, there's things like that where you're going to find something that you're playing. I've never really had a problem with that, because if it's plagiarism, fuck it, I'll use it. You know, sorry, I'm swearing. I do beg your pardon, everybody. I've been good so far. It's only the second time. What's that, Dave? Am I getting told off? Do we have one of those? Do we have the button to mute? Oh, you did. You got me. Brilliant. Boys and girls, I don't know if you saw that. Did they see that?
Oh, yeah, I think they did.
I'm sorry. I've been ever so good.
I love it. Look, Nico and Eric, what are your favorite songs, some of your favorite songs, just even a couple, that you love to play live, that you really just, you know, what are they? Eric, start with you. When you're playing, let's pick Kiss. I know you've played with a lot of different bands, but you've been with Kiss for a long time. What are a couple of favorite songs?
I would say like Parasite, some of the early, Parasite, I like 100,000 Years, stuff that this has more, a little more interesting instead of just straight timekeeping.
So Parasite and 100,000 Years?
Yeah, they're fun drum songs.
Cool, okay. Yeah.
And do you you sing great, so do you love, when you're singing, is that something you particularly like doing, the lead vocal stuff as well?
I mean, I like it, but in a perfect world, I'd rather just be a drummer. But in this particular band, you have to, which changes how I approach drumming completely, because I have to be conscious of the breathing and maintaining so I don't blow my voice out. If I play too physical, I will lose my voice. From grunting. A lot of drummers, I don't know about you, Nico, but I grunt. I grunt a lot.
You too. Oh my gosh. I get into so much trouble in the studio. They actually gag me. Because like in judo, when they do the fall and they go, I'm like, I'm just it's a subconscious thing too. I'm not physically doing it because I'm finding the drum feel difficult to play or anything like that. It's just an expression of the emotion that I'm feeling. And it's not every time, but 9 times out of 10, you'll hear me, you know, I'm actually, I talk to myself a lot, funny enough. You know, usually if Bruce is singing off like the second verse twice, I'll go.
Would you say that you're maybe sometimes singing your drum parts as you're playing them, kind of phrasing them vocally? Because that's what I find.
No, I hum them sometimes.
That's what I mean.
It's not singing. I mean, yeah. I think it's, you know, if all be told, fair, you know, every drummer's probably got something like that going on. I think it's very unlikely that they'd be totally quiet. But sometimes in a studio environment, you just, you know, you don't want to be making noises and stuff because it will be picked up by the numerous microphones around your drum set.
What do you like to play live? What are some of your favorite
for me? Well, I love all the Maiden songs, all of them. The least favorite ones, very few. But my all-time favorite Maiden tracks, "Hallowed Be Thy Name," and "Hallowed" has always been, and that's off the "Number of the Beast" album. And excuse me. And when I first joined in '83, on my first touring with Maiden, it was part of the. It was a stable song like "Iron Maiden," which finishes the set. "Hallowed," "Number of the Beast" had always been there, "Trooper," from "Peace of Mind." Now, but onwards. So you get stable songs like "Fear of the Dark's" always played now, and "Hallowed" was played every tour since I joined the band until about 5 years ago, and there was some issues with some copyright, plagiarism. Some guy accused the band of this, and it went to court, and we decided. Harry turned around, "We're not playing it." Now, here's the thing, because it's my favourite song and it's Steve's favourite song to play, I said, if you ever decide not to do it, I'm leaving the band. And I reminded Harry about that 5 years ago, and he said, I should have taken it out of the set a lot further. I said, all right, I got the drift. And the reason that song, there's something about the first couple of verses are sweet. It's easy, easy going. And then it gets into the solo section. There's three kind of sections in the solo, and they it drives in a dynamic from here to here to here. Then you've got to come back out and bring everything back down for the last verse and choruses. But there's a passion in that one song that just gets me every. It's like the first time I played it. It's one of those songs that it never gets old for me. And to be honest, none of them do. Flight of Icarus was one of my least favorite songs, but we pulled it out of retirement on the Legacy of the Beast tour. And now we found the right niche, because it was too slow when we recorded it, but it dragged at the recorded tempo. And now it's got a really nice, comfortable feeling. So and Where Eagles Dare, it's just one of those songs that I love to play because it's a drummer's track. There's so many different nuances in within the solo section, and the bass drum parts change a little bit, and never play it twice the same.
That's awesome.
That's one of the other things about playing your drums. You don't change your song, your arrangements in your playing. The only time we actually change things is at the end of a song, which we call a bird's eye. You know, blah, 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 boys and girls, get some of that, and then you finish. Now, I in a song might change where I play and position the drum fill. I might start on the 10-inch tom instead of the 12, or like vice versa. So, you don't actually change the actual part that you're playing. Very important, because otherwise you can't put a Billy Cobham fill in, because the rest of the band will go, yeah. What's right. that?
It has to be consistent and reliable within certain parameters, so everybody knows at least somewhat what to expect.
Absolutely. Yeah. No disrespect to Billy. I love his playing, too.
Oh, Cobham's amazing.
Oh, mate.
So, guys, I want to thank you very much for taking the time today. Just an amazing, amazing insight, amazing webinar. There's just so many people out there who've been looking forward to this, and they got everything they bargained for and a lot more. Incredible insight. Thank you for sharing that, Nico and Eric. Very, very grateful. On behalf of Modern Drummer, latest issue right here, Bill Ward, 1970, June issue. So thank you, everybody. ModernDrummer.com/subscribe. Well, join the club.
Before you go, I've got a bit of a Black Sabbath story for you. 1974, I toured with Black Sabbath in Europe with Streetwalkers. That was one of our first.
This time period.
And I'll tell you what, he was the first drummer I ever saw use oxygen. And he, in 1974, he hit the kit so hard, that band drove so hard because of Bill. Apart from the fact, Eric, that, you know, the riff master himself, you know, Tony, just stunning. And he was, and I was in awe of his power that he played with in those days. And he actually had oxygen bottles on the side to give me in between songs and whatnot.
So, yeah, Bill was the original animal from the Muppets.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, look at that picture of him. I don't remember him looking like that in '74, though, with all the big beard and the bushy.
Well, this is, yeah, this is 1970, literally.
And just one other thing, real quick. I did a little charity thing with Ozzy about, I must be 10 years ago now, and I hadn't seen Ozzy in a number of years, and I thought he won't remember the stories of when we were touring together. And he actually reminded me of a story that I had completely forgotten about me nearly falling off the back of the ferry coming back from Europe to Dover. And I won't tell you any more about that story, but he reminded me of it. And I thought, you remembered that? Because I didn't. And then he reminded me, and I'm like, okay, yes, I remember now. But anyway, what a great band. It must have been great playing for time.
Amazing. We got some great
conversations. Thanks so much.
Incredible. Guys, I also want to share with
you.
Modern Drummer snare drum. You can see Modern Drummer right there.
Look at that.
And yep, an absolute beauty. And this is a tribute to Rush and Neil Peart.
Yeah, I saw a picture of that. That is so. What are you going to post your mind to me, or am I going to pick it up?
I'm glad you asked, because we're going to be Modern Drummer's going to be releasing some special edition drums that we're going to offer on a limited edition to the drumming community. So be on the lookout for just some incredible designs. I also want to thank again, and let me go here to our incredible sponsors. I want to thank Pearl Drum, pearldrum.com, for all of your support, your amazing drums. Nico McBrain's Drum One, the drum shop that he always envisioned is now a reality, and man, it's a blast, online or in person. drumone.co.uk, you got to check it out for all your drum needs. moderndrummer.topeka.live, innovative virtual meet and greets. This is just the beginning of that. We all know about going backstage and having meet and greets and meeting your idols. Now it's going to be online. It's very exciting. drumchannel.com, 24/7, 365 drum education available from so many great drummers. So much learning can be done. It's very affordable, and it's just infinite in what you can learn on drumchannel.com. And of course, moderndrummer.com/subscribe. Thank you for all the support, everybody. Thank you, Nico. Thank you, Eric. Thank you, Taylor Whipple, our producer.
Yeah.
And everybody, stay safe, stay healthy, keep drumming.
Ta-da!
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Prescription products require completion of an online medication consultation with an independent healthcare provider through the LifeMD platform and are only available if prescribed. Subscription required. Individual results may vary. Additional restrictions apply at LifeMD.com. Read all warnings before using GLP-1s. Side effects may include a risk of thyroid C-cell tumors. Do not use GLP-1s if you or your family have a history of thyroid cancer.
If you've struggled for years to lose weight and have given up hope, did you know you can now access GLP-1 prescription medications through LifeMD? LifeMD is now offering eligible patients online access to GLP-1s, the breakthrough prescription medication that can help you lose body fat and weight. Listen to what people are saying.
Probably the easiest thing I've ever done. The medication comes in the mail and it's very easy to use. I've been able to live my normal lifestyle and I've lost 20 pounds already and I've never felt better. It changed my life.
And here's the best part. Your insurance may cover 100% of the cost of your medication. So go to TryLifeMD.com to have your eligibility checked right now. Get started today at TryLifeMD.com. That's TryLifeMD.com.